A new exhibition called A World of Emotions, Ancient Greece 700 BC to 200 AD, looks at the way love, hate, joy, sorrow, anger, and grief were depicted in the art of ancient Greece. The show includes more than 130 works on loan from museums in Greece and around the world, and many of them are in this country for the first time. It's on view at the Onassis Cultural Center until June 24th, and I'm very pleased to welcome to our show its co-curator, Angelos Haniotis, professor of ancient history and classics at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, and Alexander Nehamis, a professor at the Humanities and Comparative of Humanities and Comparative Literature at Princeton. Welcome to the show.
And philosophy.
Philosophy as well.
Yeah.
Which all comes into the purview of this show.
It's completely perfect in a way, though, of course, the subject is very complex and extraordinarily interesting. It's new, so we are all very excited about it.
Yeah. Now, Professor Haniotis, most of the exhibits of ancient art I've seen in the past have focused on aesthetics, on developing styles, historical themes. What led you to organize an exhibition around the theme of emotions in ancient Greek art?
I have been working on this subject for about 8 years as an ancient historian, not as a historian of art. And the reason that I came to the subject of emotions is because of my interest in social history. I have written a book, for instance, on theatrical behavior by statesmen, and I soon realized that it is impossible to study society, social life, public life, religious life, without taking into consideration emotional backgrounds, how emotions are provoked, how emotions are expressed, sometimes how emotions are displayed, not necessarily genuine emotions. So the I had a project when I was in Oxford to study the social and cultural background of emotions in the ancient Greek world. And when I was asked to co-curate an exhibition at the Onassis Center, I immediately said yes, because this, as Professor Nehamis said, this is a relatively new subject. It is not new in philosophy or the study of literature, but it's certainly new in the study of ancient history, and it has been in part ignored in the study of ancient art.
But don't most people around the world, in whatever the culture, experience love, hate, joy, sorrow, anger, grief? How does focusing on the way they were portrayed in ancient Greek art help us understand that culture?
This is a very good question. The study of emotions can be a very trivial subject, exactly for the reasons that you mentioned. We all understand emotions. We all have emotions. So what is new or what is extraordinary in the ancient Greek world? There are several answers. One of them, I'll try to be brief, is the fact that the ancient Greeks did not only create art and literature because they had emotions, this is what everybody does, but they created art and literature in order to discuss emotions. And they did this from the very beginning of the recorded Greek culture. The very first word of the oldest surviving literary work in Greek culture, and thus also in European or Western culture, the first word of the Iliad is a word of emotion, minis, anger, wrath, and the subject of the Iliad is not, as we sometimes think, the Trojan War. The subject of the Iliad is not Achilles. The subject of the Iliad is an emotion. It is the emotion of anger, and this is extraordinary.
I mean, anger as the thing that started the Trojan War.
No, the anger of Achilles when he was insulted. This is Iliad only deals with 90 days during the Trojan War, and it begins with the moment Achilles becomes angry because he has been insulted. The poem explains how his anger develops, what the consequences are, the loss of his friend Patroclus, and how his anger ends. And when the anger ends, the poem ends. And the same also applies to the next epic poem, the Odyssey. The subject of the Odyssey is Nostos, the desire of Odysseus to return to his fatherland and to his wife. With these examples, and one can go on, one can see that emotions is so central for the understanding of Greek culture that we cannot possibly ignore them. We do not study Greek culture in order to understand emotions. We will not learn anything about the grief of a mother losing a child studying the Greek culture. You can see it in any other culture, but we can understand the Greek culture by trying to understand how emotions play a part in the creation of art and literature, but also in public and religious life.
Professor Nehemas, my first thought was that Greece is the home of Stoicism. What did Plato, Aristotle, and the other Greek philosophers have to say about emotions?
Well, that's an interesting question, because there's a serious difference, I think, between the way that the Greeks look at emotions and passions in particular, and the way that Christianity and the modern world has looked at them. For the Greeks, the main issue with emotion and passion is not to do away with it. It's not to excise it from one's personality. It's to control it. And I believe, personally, that that is because the people involved, the Greeks, were by and large not particularly good at controlling their emotions. After all, people don't put up on their temples slogans praising what they already have. So when the Greeks say measure in everything, and they put that on a big temple, it's because they don't have measure. Liberty, fraternity, and equality did not become ideals until people realized they didn't have them. So with the Greeks, there's always, and not just with philosophers, but I think more generally, there's a sense that emotions have to be controlled. So all of Greek philosophy is aiming at that. The Stoics are the ones who went the farthest in that direction. Basically, they thought that emotions were just confused thoughts.
Actors wore masks that revealed the emotions of their characters. Was that a way of distancing them from the feelings?
Yes and no. There were only two kinds of masks, tragic and comic. And you really didn't get anything, any information about the emotion from the mask itself. However, we have reports according to which when the Furies, the goddesses of revenge, entered the stage to persecute Orestes, who had killed his mother, women gave premature birth. They were so scared. Now, it's probably not true, but the fact that the story could circulate shows how incredibly powerful the emotional contact was.
Professor Haniotis, when you were looking for works for this show, you were looking for works that highlighted specific emotions. How important were the aesthetic aspects of the works?
It was important, but it was not the only issue, because the exhibition does not only contain objects of art, it also contains ordinary objects. For instance, just a cup that has the inscription "For Friendship" on it and alludes to the importance of friendship in a banquet and in the household. We also have magical objects, for instance, lead figurines that were used in sympathetic magic, and believe me, they are not beautiful at all, so they are absolutely not related to any form of aesthetics. On the other hand,
and you also have some very small pieces in the show that are small oracular lead tablets with inscriptions.
Yes.
And then small clay pieces called ostraca.
Yes. So these are certainly not works of art. On the other hand, we also included some masterpieces of Greek art, because one of the questions that we ask, and we also want our audience to ask, is what are the means of an ancient artist to move us, not only to represent emotions, but to arouse emotions in us. And this is done also with aesthetic media, with the body language, with the facial expression, with the composition, sometimes just simply with the knowledge of the story. So what is, one of the characteristics of this exhibition, and I think also one of the reasons that it was successful, is the fact that it is a combination of some masterpieces of Greek art, but at the same time of ordinary objects, and it is the combination of familiarity and strangeness. On the one hand, there are objects that look familiar. We know them as artistic representations, for instance, of Eros, the personification of love. But there are also objects that make us ask, but they also make us think about analogies in our world, such as, for instance, the ostraca that were used against political enemies in Athens and in some other Greek cities.
Is that where we get the word ostracize?
Precisely. The Athenians decided once a year whether they want to hold a vote to send away for 10 years a citizen that might be a threat for democracy. If the majority was in favor of the vote, then 2 months later they held a vote, and if 6,000 citizens were present, then the citizen who received the relative majority of the votes had to go to exile for 10 years. Believe me, I resisted the temptation to organize an ostracism also during the exhibition, but I think that the result would have been obvious among at least the people who visit this exhibition.
We're talking about an exhibition called A World of Emotions, Ancient Greece, 700 BC to 200 AD, that's at the Onassis Cultural Center, which is located in the Olympic Tower at 645 Fifth Avenue. Admission is free, and it's just, I think, a wonderful show. My guests are Angelos Haniotis, professor of ancient history and classics at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, and also from Princeton, Alexander Nehamas, a professor of the humanities, comparative literature, and philosophy. And you mentioned that the Trojan War was a favorite subject, but there are some others. Another favorite was the amorous exploits of Zeus, and there are a lot of pieces there. Why were his conquests so fascinating to the ancient Greeks?
Well, they're fascinating because they created them to begin with. I have often wondered about why Zeus was quite as, how shall I put it, licentious as he was. And he was always in trouble with his wife.
Because he's the king of the gods.
He's the king of the gods. And accordingly, he can do what he wants, except what his wife doesn't like. So he's often hiding himself. He's often hiding the people that he's interested in. He changes forms. It's a very strange conception of the deity.
There's a gorgeous statue of Leda and the swan, and her emotional response to the seduction by Zeus, who has disguised himself as a swan, seems rather ambiguous.
Well, I think there are different representations of this particular myth, which is a very popular one. In fact, W.B. Yeats wrote a very famous poem on Leda and the swan. Most of the women with whom, or the people generally with whom Zeus consorted, so to speak, were not just seduced. They were often raped.
Mm-hmm. And that, well, that's why I mentioned the ambiguity, because you're not sure whether she's objecting or almost participating.
Well, on the one hand, she's being raped. On the other hand, it's the father of the gods. So, of course, she's
and
confused.
And why, if you're inventing a god, would you make him such a womanizer?
Well, it could be, since these gods were created by men, that it was envy.
Yes. Professor Haniotis.
We have to distinguish between things. The one thing is why Zeus acquired this image of the humanizer at the beginning of mythology, and another separate issue is why his amorous adventures fascinated artists and also poets, authors, and so on in later times, and we're dealing here primarily with classical art and later art. And one of the things that fascinated them is the fact that the most powerful god has someone who is even more powerful than he is, and this is love. If you look at the sculpture, for instance, with Zeus and Leda that we have in exhibit, behind him there is the son of Aphrodite, Eros, not the god of love, but love personified and deified, who is pushing Zeus. And we have also done something at the exhibition. We try to create stories that connect various objects in the exhibition. We have placed the statue of Eros, who is shooting his arrow in such a way that his arrow hits Zeus, who abducts Ganymede, in the other side of the exhibition, exactly in order to show the power of emotion. Emotions are external powers that come from outside, and they conquer us. They can conquer also the most powerful god.
On the other hand, there are a lot of works telling the story of Medea, who killed her own children. Why was that story so attractive to artists?
Well, it's inherently dramatic. And it also illustrates what Professor Haniotis was just saying, the incredible respect, fear, and admiration that the Greeks had for Eros. After all, in Hesiod's poems, which comes just a little after Homer, he's one of the very, very, very first gods to come into being. And Eros is permeates Greek thought in general. It's not always a positive feeling. Eros is not like philia, which is closer to something like friendship or being able to get along with people. Eros is a very strong passion that takes over. And very often, though, for example, Plato, in his Symposium, a very famous work of his, praises Eros again and again and again. In the Republic, another work of his, Eros is actually a very bad force.
But then we have all of the plays, and they sometimes contradict each other. Sophocles will present the gods or the stories in a different way from Euripides or Aeschylus.
Oh, absolutely, because first of all, they depend on slightly different stories, and also because Greek religion, unlike, say, the Christian church, doesn't have a dogma. So there are very different stories, very often contradictory, that are told about the same gods.
One of the highlights of the show are two marble heads of Achilles and Penthesilea, the queen of the Amazons. Mm-hmm. What's the story behind those sculptures, Dr. Haniotis?
Yeah, the story is narrated in a lost epic. It is the sad story of Achilles fighting against the Amazon Penthesilea, killing her, and the moment she dies, he wants to see who his opponent is. He lifts her helmet, sees her beautiful face, admires her vigor and power, but also her beauty, and realizes that he's falling in love with her. And in the moment that his love is being born, the woman that he loves dies. And this is, again, a very dramatic story. It is a story that can be narrated in different ways, and different aspects are highlighted. And one of the unique aspects of the exhibition is that the viewer, the visitor, has the possibility to see two different versions. In one version, in the two marble heads, the two persons are so alike that you cannot easily distinguish between Achilles and Penthesilea. They look like twin siblings. The other interesting fact is that although the story places emphasis on the gaze, the fact that they look at each other and they fall in love, the sculptor has represented them not looking at each other in order to arouse the feeling of loss and the sorrow in the story. And we have an entirely different version on an extremely beautiful vase from Munich, in which the two heroes look at each other, and Penthesilea, with her last power, her last strength, reaches out to Achilles as if in an effort to grasp into life and to love. And in these cases, again, the exhibition gives us an opportunity to distinguish between the representation of emotion, the representation of love, and the emotion that it arouses in us, the viewers, and this is sorrow, grief about this tragedy.
There are a number of funerary stelae, understandably, but one of the most fascinating is the funerary stelae for a lovable pig, victim of a traffic accident. Would we understand what was happening if there wasn't also a lot of text on that stelae?
On that one, I think we'd probably have some trouble, though, of course, Professor Haniotis would be more capable of answering the question. I certainly wouldn't. But the text is hilarious. It's quite wonderful.
Were the deaths of pigs and other animals mourned in the same way as humans?
Not that I know. I found the big
dogs were...
Well, dogs really always. Always.
Yeah. Still the case.
Absolutely. Yeah. From the very
and I know of a grave epigram for a chicken, but the grave epigram for the pig is really unique. And again, I have to tell a background story and a joke, because me and the two co-curators, Nikos Kaltsas and Ioannis Milonopoulos, did this with a lot of joy. And there is a joke behind this, and this is the fact that this pig, the lovable pig, wanted to travel. What the grave inscription narrates are its travels, starting from Durazzo in modern Albania and going to Macedonia and being killed on the road. And since the pig could not travel any further, we at least brought the funerary monument for the pig from Macedonia to New York.
There's a lot of travel involved in this show because some of the pieces, although they were made in Attica, wind up being unearthed in Italy, for example, within Etruscan tombs. And the works in the show include sculptures, pottery, other objects on loan from 22 museums in Greece, including the Acropolis, National Archaeological Museum in Athens, and then the Louvre, the British National, the British Museum, Vatican, other museums in Germany. How many are being seen in this country for the first time?
I wouldn't be able to tell you on the top of my head, because sometimes we do not have records about exhibits that are in provincial museums. For instance, the fresco from Pompeii, a wonderful fresco depicting Agamemnon covering his head after he has revealed his decision to sacrifice his daughter. This is certainly for the first, possibly the last time that is seen
Amazing.
In the United States. And the reason is that frescoes don't travel. And we are extremely grateful to the museum in Naples that allowed us to see this wonderful fresco together with a vase that again shows a different version of the sacrifice.
Can I say something?
We have very little time. Go ahead.
Well, Agamemnon's face is covered. We don't see it. Now, one could say that his grief must be so great that it couldn't be depicted. I think by not showing the grief, they communicate it much, much better in a more moving way.
Is this a unique experience, or is this show going to travel?
We don't know yet.
We hope that it will travel, but it has not been confirmed yet.
Meanwhile, people can see it for free at the Anassis Cultural Center, which you enter through the lobby of the Olympic Tower at 646 Fifth Avenue across from St. Patrick's Cathedral. My great thanks to my two guests, Angelos Chaniotis and Alexander Hamas, for being on our show today.